What number is this, Chip?
Headquarters, side 2.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know. Zilch.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
Welcome to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast. Today, we're discussing Headquarters, side 2. But before we do that, let's check out the Monkeys mailbag.
P.O. Box 9847.
Sandy Feifel Zabriskie writes in and says, I have to say a huge thank you to Ken and the group who work very hard on the podcast. For years, I thought I was the only one who was crazy for the Monkees. My one and only concert that my wonderful hubby took me to when we were newlyweds was a Monkee concert in Massachusetts in 1986. It's so nice to know that I am not alone. Keep up the great work. Sandy, we hope you and your hubby enjoy our show, and trust me, you're not alone. We're all out there. We all love this band and all the great smiles that they've put on our face over the years. And from our iTunes reviews, if you'd like to leave us a review on iTunes, it's one great way to let people know that the show is out there on iTunes and they will give us a good rating. This is from Jay Brooms with a 5-star rating. Thank you for doing such a wonderful job on the podcast. I'm a new listener and have been a fan since I was a kid. The Monkees are the only artists that I loved as a child, a teen, and then again as an adult. I've always loved the TV show, but have just recently discovered all the great music that somehow escaped me all these years. You guys are putting the icing on the cake with these podcasts. Please keep it up, and congratulations. Thank you, Jay Brooms. And now, let's get on with our discussion of Headquarters, Side 2.
That was a little too long.
Of my opinion that the people are intending.
It is of my opinion that the people are intending.
Zilch, China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda.
Zilch, never mind the furthermore, the play is self-defense. Never mind the furthermore.
I think you got it now, Mickey.
And the Zilch Roundtable has commenced. On my charming and talented left is the wonderful, charming and talented Jeff Hewlett.
Hello, everybody.
The talented and wonderful Craig Cohen.
Thank you, Ken.
And the ever effervescent Craig Smith.
Little Metal Bottle Tops.
And the charming and delightful Sarah Clark.
Hello.
And I am Ken Mills. All right, and here we are on side 2 of the famous album Headquarters by the Monkees.
We will make the world
on this discussion, Sarah Clark, would you like to take for Pete's sake?
Happily. This is easily Peter's poppiest composition as far as pop music sound. It was totally the perfect choice to close out the closing credits for the second season. It sort of comes off as almost a mission statement for the second season of the show, you know, because they're really embracing the love and the freedom and the whole vibe of their independence and of the 60s in general. I gotta say, Nez is not shabby on the Hammond B3. He does a really good job on the organ. And also, I would suggest that folks check out the Shoe Suede Blues version of this song on the album Cambria Hotel. Peter does the most delightfully tongue-in-cheek rearrangement of it that you can imagine. Anything that includes both the banjo and the sitar in a song gets my mix vote, so gets my vote.
Understanding, don't you know that this is true? Love is understanding, it's in everything we do. In this generation, in this loving time, in this generation, we will make the world to shine. Something we all need. We were born to love one another. We must be what we're going to be. And what we have to be is free.
Craig Cohen.
Yeah, it's a great tune, and this is really makes me wonder what a Monkees with more songwriting involvement with Peter Tork would have been like, because this is such a strong song. And Sarah talked about the organ, which is just so great. I think this is one of the better sort of band sounding songs to me. The organ's probably really contributing to that fullness that I'm hearing. But yeah, I can't say enough good things about this song. And Mickey's vocal is top notch.
Who is Joseph Richards? He writes the song with Peter Tork. Any info from anybody?
Wasn't it one of his roommates or something? Or did I dream that?
That sounds familiar, but I don't know with certainty.
Don Kirshner's little brother. Okay, Jeff Hewlett.
Oh, I railroaded myself into the next up. Well, I don't have a lot to add to what other people have said. I love the use of the organ in this track. I think it's well done. I think the minimalist arrangement doesn't hurt this song. I think overall it's great, and I love the fact that it made it into the credit sequence. And this song, more than any other Monkey song, I think really embraces the hippie movement. Uh-huh. And the peace and love and the brotherly love of the mid to late 60s. And it's kind of anthemic in a way. I don't know if it really achieved what it could have achieved. There was a lot of 60s hippie anthems back then, and I think this could have fit in with the rest of them, but I don't know if it really achieved that level of greatness that it could have if it was in a smaller running crowd. But definitely a solid track from this record.
Craig Smith.
Two things. One, the organ, which has been mentioned. It was also nice to see Mike reprise that role on stage in recent tours, playing those organ licks. And Peter's guitar lick, which is just anybody that grew up on the Monkees, at least in the Nickelodeon eras, where they replaced even the first season credits with the second season theme. It's just kind of... It's as ubiquitous as the opening drum roll on the Monkey, theme from the Monkees. It's just such a great song opening and such a great lick. And just a great song all around. The thing I always think of when I think about this song, when I received all of the Monkees LPs for Christmas, I did not know what this song was. And I remember reading books, or at least reading A Monkey's Tale, which I had at that time, trying to figure out what song this was. And I'll never forget, like, dropping the needle on every track that I didn't know, looking for this song.
Wow.
And finally found it, years later.
I share a similar story along that, trying to find out what song that was when I was a very young child. The riff is just amazing. And, Jeff, you mentioned how if this were a different band, or it could have reached more of an audience. It's one of those subliminal things that people were hearing about Peace and Love, you know, while there was little Kellogg's things flying over top and the pictures of the boy's head and all that. So that's not a bad thing. But had another band done this song, like the Mamas and Papas or something like that, I think this would be one of those staples that you hear all the time on radio. I think it was a victim of the Monkees
phenomenon. I agree on that, Ken. Great point.
Well, usually the only great point I have is the one on top of my head, as my wife reminds me, so.
Or the one a little lower. Oh,
hey-o! Sorry. All right, our next track is Mr. Webster.
Everyone in town knew Mr. Webster. He worked at the bank for 40 years. And each week Mr. Frisbee made his check out for $68 clear. And through the years he thwarted 27 robberies. Each time Frisbee promised him a raise.
Craig Smith, please take this one.
I have a feeling that I'm going to be alone in my enjoyment of this track. I've
not
always
at all, Craig Smith.
No, you're not.
Wow. Okay.
Because yes, I was you just are. Getting.
I knew Jeff would be the dissenting opinion. I mean, it's just it's got. I love the story. It's just such a great kind of unexpected story about this guy. And the arrangement, I think, is great. The moodiness of the track is particularly well served. And I particularly like the end before the final verse, where it kind of goes into that slow bit and speeds back up and the song comes back in. And just the way the song ends, absolutely perfect. I think this song is just a home run. It's incredible.
Craig Cohen.
I can't agree more. This was the song the first time I heard it. I was giddy as the song progressed and the story unfolded. And Craig Smith is so on point in terms of the arrangement here. It really helps set a scene. And I think this is a great example of the comedy that the Monkees could be so good at. You know, it's a great comedy track, and it's not a novelty track, which... I think there's a huge difference there. So this is really one of the songs that I always look forward to when I listen to this album.
Written by Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart. Sarah, you take this and we'll let Jeff have the opposing view.
Okay. Well, we've talked about a lot about some of the tracks on this album being a little thin in sound. I think that actually is one of the things that works to the favor of Mr. Webster. It comes off as very... almost deliberately spare or minimalist, so you just hone in on the story of the song. I really like Mike Nesmith's steel work on this track, steel guitar work, but I was really surprised to learn that Mickey was playing the guitar on it.
Yeah,
that was a pleasant surprise. I don't think he gets enough credit for his guitar work either. It really is kind of a shame that his like acoustic style wasn't appropriate for more Monkees tracks, because that gives this song a lot of subtlety. And his acting on this song is excellent. You know, there's no like ba-dum-tsh at the end. There's no wink to the audience. He just plays the whole thing utterly straight, and I love kind of the unresolved ending of the music at the end.
I love how it's almost an appreciation of the villain in this case. You know, the guy finally, the one person he had to worry about robbing the place was a guy he treated like crap all those years. And I
thought you meant Jeff.
Oh, no.
I was basking in that.
You said villain.
Sarah mentioned the very end of the song. You actually do get the feeling that they've locked the door with that sense of regret and the silence that's there. It's just very cool.
And Mr. Frisbee locked the door.
Jeff, the floor is yours.
Oh, it's mine. You know, I know everybody was sitting there with bated breath waiting for me to be the big villain on this, but I'm not going to be the big villain. I may be like kind of like the hobbled Lex Luthor to all of your Supermans on this one, and say that I don't dislike this, but I just like the Missing Links version a hell of a lot better.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I think the arrangement of the Missing Links version is a little bit better. I think the instrumentation and the arrangement of the Missing Links version, it kind of adds to the buildup of the tension in this, and I feel that it adds to the theatrical execution of this track a little bit better. I feel like the minimalistic Monkees Only version that shows up on Headquarters just doesn't feel the same. It doesn't feel as dramatic. I feel that it was executed better, in my opinion, in other recorded versions of this. And, you know, I understand people can disagree with me on this, and I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but it's just a matter of personal preference. And I've always felt that, I've felt that since I heard the Missing Links version of this, that I liked it better than the album version.
It just clicked with you.
Yes.
What did you think of Mickey's lead vocal?
No, it's great. It's good, and it's a good story. Uh-huh. It's very entertaining, and I love that it's kind of an anti-song in a way that it kind of takes a break from the album. I'm a big fan of instrumentals. I'll throw my hat there out there and say that I love instrumental music. This is an instrumental, but instrumentals are usually used as a break to take you out of the experience of the album. Give your brain a bit of a rest from the songs that have been going on. And in Headquarters respect, this is sort of a little bit of a vocal story to kind of take you away from the songs and the kind of the top 40 fodder and potentially any sort of other mental baggage, and just take you on a little bit of a journey in the middle of the record. Uh-huh. And I think that it was just executed better in prior productions.
Very good. Well, why don't you take lead on what is perhaps my favorite song on the album? I can go back and forth on that depending on the day, but I love the song Sunny Girlfriend. Your thoughts on it?
Oh man, Ken, now you're really putting me in a difficult position, because this to me is my least favorite track.
Really?
Seriously, where's the disconnect button on this guy?
Yeah. Oh my god, the lyrics are just so not.
Wait a second, hold on. Stop.
This can't be happening.
Wait a second.
No,
okay,
we are gonna
reboot.
She owns and operates her own sunshine factory.
Okay, hold on. I'm gonna interrupt
guys,
you.
Really?
Jeff.
Guys,
please,
really.
Jeff, please
really,
let me
guys?
Interrupt you.
Guys, really.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to reboot this conversation, and we're gonna have you back
this.
Clean up at the end, okay?
You're gonna edit me out, and I understand
that's fine. No. You're gonna get everything that you wanna say, but we're gonna go through our basking. And then you're going to come in at the end of it, okay?
Come on.
I'm going to leave it just like it is. Everybody's hearing all of this.
No.
Okay.
Come on. You can't say that this song stacks up nearly as well lyrically as the rest of Nesmith's contributions to the Monkees catalog. You can't possibly come at me with that. You can't. You can't. It's an attempt at a pop song. Just doesn't measure up to the rest of it. You can't tell me this holds up to his other contributions, even on this own in this record. You can't. Come on.
Is your problem with the lyrics or the performance?
The lyrics. That's it.
All right. Well, let's go through the lyrics. She owns and operates her own sunshine factory.
Come on.
I always thought that that was either a reference to a brothel or drugs or just something that makes you feel good.
Now Hugh, it's all about it.
Come on, Ken. Bring it. Read the rest of them off.
A painting
Come on,
smiles on dolls and then on me. And then she makes him smile. She's my sunny girlfriend and personality. So she like turns the trick on him. Like,
right.
You know what I'm talking about. She's got a book and that tells about everybody's past. So she's keeping track on what she's going on. To me, this kind of ventures into the same territory as like Cuddly Toy. And, you know, we're talking about I feel sex, you know.
My thought's drugs.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Dolls or pills? I don't know.
Huh.
Thank you, Sarah. You're helping reinforce my point.
Okay. Anyway, she's got a book that tells about everybody's past.
Just, it feels so amateurish against the rest of his contributions.
Oh my god! She's either got a book about everybody's past where she's keeping track of the drug deals, or who's visited who. Mm-hmm. And this is one of my favorite lines right here. And she can make you slow while making your mind move fast. That's like all where... Right,
it is drugs.
Yeah.
You think so?
Okay.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
Yeah, but to me, being the horn dog that I am, it's kind of like, you know, she can make you slow, saying you...
That's what I thought, too. I've been selling this thing. It's like a GPG-rated podcast.
Yeah, seriously. I got the talking to from Ken before we started recording the first episode. He's like, yeah, I know you come from the Kiss world. That's not what we're doing here.
This is the monkey's world. Yeah, but anyhow. So she's making you move slow. You know, saying, hold on, it's going to be worth it. And your mind is moving fast. She's my sunny girlfriend. And she's never last. So that's all he's thinking about. So either if it's drugs.
I was hoping that somebody would keep the low note on that.
Oh, sorry. And then while I am sleeping, then she comes creeping into my thoughts at night, gazing down through eyes as bright as wonder.
As red as thunder.
So this chick is like into his head. I mean, this is all he's thinking about. Or if it's drugs, you know.
Ken Mills. Take this song,
yes,
and stack it against other Nesmith songs. Tell me which Nesmith songs in the Monkees catalog are not as good as this.
I don't know, man. I'm not wired.
I got the rest of the night
like
for
that.
This. I got the rest of the night.
I'm not wired to think about it like that.
They have
I will
Nez
say,
songs?
Yes, bring it on, Craig Smith. Tell
well,
me
hold
what
on, hold
Nesmith
on, hold
songs
on a second.
Lyrically are not as good as this.
I
never
feel
tell a woman yes. Is yeah. is that? Is
I that hate that him? Song. I hate that song.
I do too. I can't stand either of the. I know the other one is.
Okay.
Not Nezrit and Oklahoma Backroom Dancer. I can't stand
either
of those.
Okay, so there's two Nez songs in your opinion, Craig Smith, that are not as good as this lyrically. So which other ones are not?
I'm still thinking. Hold on.
Keep going.
Tapioca
include
Tundra.
Include unreleased. Feel free to include unreleased songs.
Tapioca
in this.
Tundra okay. is not as good as Sunny Girlfriend.
I'm gonna punch you through this microphone. Ken.
Wow.
No. Your argument is invalid, Ken.
Well, it actually no, it's just opinion, and this is how we go. But to me, I feel that this is just an amazing song. I love the energy of the performance on this track. I love the recent live version they did, where it's kind of like every time they click the ViewMaster, you see a different girl. It's that kind of thing. I think this is just an excellent, strong song, and the one voice that hasn't been heard at all is Craig Cohen. Craig, you're weighing on it.
I got to say that I key in on the same thing you key in on, which is the energy level of this song.
Uh-huh.
I think the performance energy is great, and I think Mike's vocal is really, you know, he's in like his full Kenny Rogers mode there. And I see Jeff's point on the lyrical content, but I think the performance sells the lyric, and it sort of wraps the whole song together.
Yeah, it is a song that is saved by the performance on it to an extent. I don't think it's the strongest Nez tune. I don't think it's the worst one out there. I don't think it's the strongest one on this album, but the energy that is brought to it sort of elevates it.
Well, she's my sunny girlfriend, and she just doesn't care.
Can I go back to sets of Nez lyrics that are a little more trite than this?
Yes.
Go ahead.
What about The Kind of Girl I could Love, which is a song that I love? Song. But come on, look at the lyrics.
That's
girl,
a real pop song.
You look mighty good to me.
That's a pop song.
I can tell
song.
That you've got to be the kind
it's
of girl I could
pop
love.
Pop song.
I agree, but I don't think that it's better lyrically than Sunny Girlfriend.
You're right into a different audience, man. That was a great pop song. This is kind of like, I don't know. He's writing it when he's sitting on the toilet. I don't know.
Wow.
This is a transitional song for Ned.
This is a transitional episode.
This is when it got real.
Hey, this is my exit to Zilch, guys. This is where the
no.
audience ousts me.
No, never. Never, never.
Wow.
No.
I'm ready to just throw it all away.
This is when we have Wrestle Armageddon kind of thing, which is some sort of pay-per-view. We'll have to charge people to the future recordings of these.
Yeah.
But it's all opinions, and right or wrong or whatever, that's in the judge of the person listening, and they'll have their opinion, and I'm sure they'll let us know on Facebook. But I'm surprised out of all the songs that we would have such a strong disagreement about, it would be this one.
I know, I kind of am too. Jeff, have you always felt this way about this song? I mean,
yes.
You appreciated it early on?
No, I did not. Shades of Grey I loved more when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
And as I got older, I faded on it. But Zilch audience, if this part is left in the episode, I will say that my reviews in the next three records will be so far superior to this that you may want to leave me intact.
Wow. Well,
that's a promise.
Man, you are in this, and nothing's going to change that. So
we'll
it's
see.
All good. And I love you, and I may not agree with you.
I love you too, Ken.
I love you.
I love you, Ken.
And I love you, Jeff. Well, I think Sunny Girlfriend's a great song. This will make for an interesting drive when we're going down the road and this song comes on. I'm going to be thinking, is he going to hit the fast forward button? So, is that symbol backwards, guys?
I believe it is.
I thought
either that,
that
or it's either that or it's faded up.
Ah.
I'm actually thinking that it was probably played live and then just faded up. The track was faded up because I don't know that I see them going to the trouble to record the cymbal backwards.
I've actually done that though. I've taken a cymbal and ran it backwards, and it does sound like that. But anyway.
Oh no, it's absolutely the sound of a backwards cymbal. Yeah. I just don't know.
It would have been a lot harder. It would have been hard to pull off.
Yeah, I mean you're talking pre Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know that Chip would have been the one to be like, yeah, let's.
Right.
I mean, it was done on the end of Rain in 1966 with Lennon's vocal. So I mean, backwards stuff was happening, but I don't know if I see them doing that or flying it in. Mm-hmm. I think I'd have to listen to the headquarters sessions. I bet you can probably hear during the master track if it was played straight, Andrew might have left that stuff alone, but I don't remember offhand. Listeners,
what do you think? Is it played backwards or pushed up? Let's go on to the next track.
You know, it's funny that Jeff Hewlett's version of Headquarters also has 13 tracks, but it's missing this one. He'll listen to Band 6, a good four or five times over to make up for the space.
Band 6
lost.
Is better than Sunny Girlfriend. I'll say that.
Oh my God!
Now you're trolling.
Oh!
That's the end of the tricorder transmission.
Oh man. Wow. Well, our next track is Zilch.
Zilch. Mr. Davalina, Mr. Bob Davalina. Mr. Davalina, Mr. Bob Davalina.
Zilch. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda.
Zilch. China Clipper calling Alameda. Self defense. Never mind the furthermore, the plea of self defense. Never mind the furthermore, the plea of self defense.
It is of my opinion that the people are intending. It is of my opinion that the people are intending.
Jeff, tell us why this is better than. Tell us why Zilch is better than Sunny Girlfriend.
Oh my God. Well, this is essentially the Monkees version of Row, Row, Row Your Boat, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah.
It's kind of like a comedy number. I don't know if I've ever truly understood this track, it's fun to listen to. Mm-hmm. It's almost like this was the vocal exercise they were going through before they actually sung any songs for this record. So I don't know if this is a great track or not, but the fact that our podcast is named after this, I can't say that I don't like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This Zilch could actually be the vocal section in any Fish song.
Well, there you go. Zilch was used in the TV episode The Picture Frame during the police interrogation scene when Mike, Mickey, and Davey are commanded by the sergeant to start talking. The boys initially respond with Zilch lyrics, so there you go.
All right, my fine feathered monkeys, start talking! The robbery!
Craig Smith, any thoughts on this one?
I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. For what it is, I think it's kind of a neat little interlude. I mean, it's the kind of thing where, you know, when I got into the Monkees, Head was my favorite album because it had all of those weird bits between the songs. Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of a cool thing, like opening the record, seeing that short little track that wasn't band six in the middle of the record, and then just dropping the needle and being like, well, that's different. It's interesting. And I just think it's a cool little, you know, it's not meant to be viewed as anything other than a little between song bit of psychobabble, right?
Right. Craig Cohen.
The main thing this song really illustrates to me is that the four Monkees were really on board and invested and believed in each other, because this isn't the type of song that you'd expect Davy Jones to really, you know, be down with. It's sort of got that Nesmith strangeness that we'll see, especially in a solo career. Uh-huh. But really, for me, it's really fun as a band, really just having fun together and trusting each other. And it also gave me the idea to eventually check into a hotel under the name Bob Dabalina at some point in my life.
Well, we've all done that, let's be honest. Sarah, your thoughts?
Nicely done.
Never mind, but furthermore, the plea is self-defense. I can't be logical about this track, because it's like you run into certain TV shows or songs or, you know, dumb things when you're 9 years old, and they just make you giggle for no reason whatsoever. And my 9-year-old comes out every time I hear this song, but in a good way, as opposed to in a mopey way with Shades of Grey. And it's just, I agree with everything that was already said as far as just it kind of showing the chemistry of the band and just kind of being this lighthearted little bit of fun, which is, at the end of the day, kind of what the Monkees were about when they were at their best.
Do you guys remember you used to go to, like, stores and they'd have those phones all over the place and you could, like, pick it up, just say, Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina, please report to the service desk or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can do that anymore without being tasered by Walmart police, but anyway, I don't recommend you try it anymore.
I would actually like your opinion on something, all
sure.
of you. Cool or a regrettable mistake, saying Zilch at the wrong time and coming in late?
Cool.
Cool.
I'm going to go with cool.
Okay.
Jeff?
Ah, I was hoping to skate past without anybody noticing. I guess cool. I don't know. Overall, I think I would have liked the track better if they'd have stayed on character the whole time and not broken down. I think it would have been a cooler round if they would have just kind of maintained it without breaking into a laughter all the way through. But I don't know.
But the breakdown is what makes it funny.
It doesn't need to be funny, though. It could have been a really great exercise in vocal round.
Jeez, Jeff, if they would have not broken down, the track would have, like, locked to the outer groove and played for infinity.
Right.
It would have been a Fish track.
Well, the next track, No Time, has a line from Zilch in it, and we'd like to thank the Monkees for naming Zilch, you know, that gave us our nomenclature, the name for our show, so, hey, it definitely spawned that, so that's cool. Mm-hmm. The next track is No Time, written by the Monkees, but credited to recording engineer Hank Sekalo as a tip for his work on the album.
Yes. Hoba-reba, cyber-soban, hoba-seba-snack, seba-rabber, hoba-soban, what did you expect? No time.
No time, no time, no time.
No time for you.
No time, no time at all.
I got no time, baby, got lots of better things to do.
No time, no time.
It's the best song song that ever bought a sound engineer's house.
There you go. Lead vocal by Mickey Dolenz. No Time was actually composed by the Four Monkees. According to Peter, composition was done primarily by Mickey and Mike. But as a reward for his hard work, the band credited to the song engineer, guaranteeing him a large royalty check. The release version of this song was the second version recorded for the album. The first included session help from guitarists Keith Allison and Jerry Yester, but the release version has only Chip Douglas assisting the quartet, and Keith Allison was in the Raiders. So, anyway. So, Craig Cohen, your thoughts on No Time?
For me, this song comes an album too late. I think this is the song that really sort of stands out like a sore thumb on this. It's just, I don't want to say it's too rocking for this album, but it just seems like the band had sort of moved beyond this type of song at this point, this sort of garagey, you know, foot stomping type of song, and which I tend to love, but mm-hmm. here it's just surrounded.
We remember
by
Let's Dance On from episode one.
Yes.
Every party you've ever thrown.
Exactly. But for me, this song just doesn't work in this collection of songs.
Now, would this song work on the Monkees dance playlist for any party you have? Would this totally.
Yeah, this definitely makes the Monkees party playlist. But
so would this be on right after Let's Dance On, or would you wait a little bit to pull everybody back up?
You see, that's really a DJ choice, Ken. I think it depends on where in the night I'm pacing things. But
you don't plan a playlist when you're right. DJing a show. It's all. Well, it's all what happens, spur of the moment.
Well, you need to write this down so when the Drunkies play our annual summer Zilch picnic, that they can nice. They can.
I think that would be a nice 1-2 punch. Let's Dance On right into No Time. That would probably make a really cool, twofer.
All right, Sarah?
I got to say, I actually think it works well on Headquarters, because Headquarters is... taken as a whole, it is a kind of loose garage bandy album, mm-hmm. and I think it, and this is one of kind of the looser tracks on a album that in a way is very loose, but its looseness makes it really, I think, one of the most fun tracks on that album to listen to, because they're just having a heck of a time, and Mickey, both singing and drums, he just knocks this one out of the park, and he just goes after it, hell-bent for leather.
When they play this song on the last tour, it almost has a punk feel when it starts out. You're like, well, what song is this? Jeff Hewlett, your thoughts on No Time?
Well, Ken, I this is another one of those tracks on this album, and, you know, I typically don't like to compare a band against another band, but No Time for me has always been mentally compared to I'm Down.
Oh, yeah.
By the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I love Mickey's vocals on this track, but for some reason, it doesn't feel like he went far enough to me. If you listen to Paul's vocals on I'm Down, you know, he just goes completely crazy and goes really hardcore and insane with the vocals, and I don't think that Mickey's vocals, he's got a lot of enthusiasm, but for me mentally, I always compare this to I'm Down, and one of my favorite Mickey vocals of all time, and it's not an album track, it's a single track, and it's Going Down, and I love... I love Mickey's vocal abilities, and for some reason, to me, I can't separate this song from other songs. And as much as I like this track, I always kind of try to. I don't want to mentally compare this to other tracks, but I always seem to compare it to other tracks. Mm-hmm. And it's a, like kind of a 3-star out of 5-star track for me, but it's kind of not fair for me to do that, because it's me comparing it to other Mickey vocals in the Monkees catalog, and of course going and I'm Down by the Beatles.
And you mentioned the Beatles. Mickey's Rock On George for Ringo One Time refers to the Beatles' version of Honey Don't.
Mm-hmm. Rock on George to Ringo One Time.
So there you go. Craig Smith, your thoughts on No Time?
No Time is an interesting track in that. And I don't know that any other Monkees tracks do this for me. I only like it within the context of this album. I like it following Zilch, and I kind of like what it brings to the album at this point, but I will never listen to it on its own. And the reason for that is it kind of like what Jeff said about I'm Down. It's a very standard 1-4-5 chord progression, and it's a chord progression and a type of song that has been done to death. And the arrangement here doesn't really bring, if you're going to do that sort of song, it's got to have a killer guitar solo or something to set it apart. And as a song on its own, I don't think it does that. But in the context of the album, I like when it comes around. I would just never seek it out on its own. However, any song that opens with an homage to Bill Cosby is okay by me.
Yeah, it works. That's a great point. That's a great point.
Do you know that whole bit about the Bill Cosby thing?
Yeah, why don't you tell us about it?
It was a Bill Cosby album. I think it was it might have been his first record, and I believe he's talking about how they would like you'd be at an airport and you'd be waiting for your flight, and they would announce your flight, but all you'd hear is Hober, Reber, Sober, and I remember Mickey telling a story at one of the Monkees conventions about how they would listen to these Bill Cosby albums and just, like, you know, roar with laughter, I believe were his words. And so Hober, Reber, and it was used somewhere else. I want to say it was used in an episode or was it an episode where
I can't pinpoint the episode, but yes, I believe you're correct.
It was.
Yeah. So that's Hober, Reber.
Hober, Reber.
So I talked to him after the show was over, and I said, I think you guys are really great. Where do you go from here? And he said, well, one by one, they take us over to the Greyhound bus station, and they let us announce where the buses are going. See, what they do is they get the guys all juiced up. You know, it's bus leaving on station number 7-4, Reber, Sack, Hober, Sober, Sack, and North Reber Highway.
Thanks for bringing up Bill Cosby, by the way.
Yeah, awesome.
Wonderfulness is a great record if you want to buy a Bill Cosby record.
Love Wonderfulness. The first one I heard was To Russell My Brother, Whom I Slept With. And
great
that
one, too.
I love all those early Bill Cosby records.
Our next track, as we're getting close to the end of the album proper, is a very wonderful song called Early Morning Blues and Greens.
Distant night bird mocks the sun. I wake as I have always done. Two freshly scented sycamore and cold bare feet on hardwood floor. My steaming coffee warms my face. I'm disappointed in the taste. But there's a peace the early brings. The morning world of growing things.
Craig Smith, you asked me one time, because I mentioned I didn't really care for the organ solo in She.
I knew that's where we were going.
And you said, well, name one that works. And I think that the keyboard in this is amazing, and not only is it amazing, it's transcendent.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what is that cymbal that you hear, that crashing sound? What is that?
The pfft.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what that. It's not a gong. That bong, bong, bong.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's definitely a great organ piece. That I just love this song. What are your thoughts, Craig Smith?
just a great... this is another track that I think just benefits from the mood, much like Mr. Webster.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, a great lyric. Just a great lyric and a great... You know, you're starting off with a great song to begin with, but I think that Davey's vocal again is one of his best, and I really think that the organ on this just really it does transcend it. It makes it epic, and mm-hmm. you know there are times where I wish the album kind of ended on this track because I love the ending of this, even maybe just like. Maybe going on just a little longer and kind of jamming out with that organ thing a little. I think it's just got a great mood to it. One of my favorites.
And that clanging sound that I'm talking about, it almost gives it a Middle Eastern or Oriental slight effect.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Cohen?
I'm a big fan of this song. I will be the charter member of the fan club if it doesn't have one. It's just such a great marriage of music, lyrics, and vocals. You have a really sort of poetic set of lyrics here. It's another song that paints a great, great picture. I'm a big fan of songs that create images in my head. And this one really creates images in my head when he says things like, a distant nightbird mocks the sun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my steaming coffee warms my face.
You usually think of this one on Monday mornings when you're starting work.
I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you were saying, sir?
You know, and I also agree with Craig in the sense that this really would be a great closer for the album if they decided to go that way.
Jeff Hewlett?
Oh, I'm so glad that you guys all mentioned the fact that this is a song that you would think of in your adult lives as you were getting ready for the workday on a Monday morning, right? So now I'm not going to say that I don't like the song because I agree with the rest of you guys that this is the lyric is incredibly insightful and it's a wonderful insight into the things that all of us face in our adult lives on an almost a daily basis aside from Saturdays and Sundays unless you work on Saturdays and Sundays of course
right
but. I'm going to offer up a different perspective on this song and not to say that it's bad or indifferent but. Think about the monkeys, who they were directed at, who was the target audience of the monkeys television show and the songs. Now,
Ken
this
Mills.
Song, right, it was Ken Mills. But now think about it. You, this song and the lyrics of this song, would a young person or a teenager in the late 60s really understand the gravity of these lyrics and almost the repetitive a rigmarole that the adults who this song was really about, would they really understand that? And not to say I'm not saying it's bad. Don't anybody think that I'm saying it's bad. I'm just I'm questioning the target audience of the monkeys at the time. Were they really able to understand everything that this song was saying?
Mm-hmm. No, because they were listening to Sunny Girlfriend. Right.
Exactly. So when I was younger. And I listened to this album when I was a young person in the 80s. When I first was introduced to this, I didn't necessarily understand what the song was about. Now here I am, I'm 40 years old, and I listen to these lyrics and go, God, this is what I go through on a daily basis, and it's depressing to think that this is my life. And you know, back then in 1987, when I was I was still in school at the time, I didn't quite understand what this meant. And for now that I'm here, I am looking back on it as an older person who's in, working life. I'm wondering, is this something that transcended the monkeys? Is this something that was written with an older audience in mind but recorded by a band who was selling themselves to a younger audience? Mm-hmm. Was this something that's kind of lost to the ages only to be rediscovered later on in life by monkeys fans?
Interesting.
You bring up some great points. It kind of lyrically reminds me of Sometime in the Morning without the happy ending of it.
Totally.
Like, for example, you have, I feel the moments hurry on. It was today, it's died away, and now it is forever gone, and I will drink my coffee slow, and I will watch my shadow grow and disappear in firelight and sleep alone again tonight. I thought that, Jeff, you were going to mention that it was an out-of-character song for Davey to do, especially since he probably rarely slept alone. at night.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, that's something else that's happened, you know, on this album prior to this. And I love that Davey, now that he's out of the, you know, out from under the thumb of Kirshner, he took the, or I'm not sure how it was decided, but he took the opportunity to break character, if you will, of his person on the TV show and branch out a little bit. And I think this is a great example of Davey not being what the audience expected him to be.
There was a time I was wondering if Mike wrote this before, you know, when, because it just seemed to be more along his vibe, you know, when I was younger, and I didn't really pay attention to who wrote what. But I always wondered if this was something that Mike had written. But I could hear Mickey doing this very easily. And I,
well, it's interesting. I mean, Peter had said for years that he should have been the one to sing this song.
Mm-hmm. I think and Peter finally did great.
On the, you know, the most recent Monkees tours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sarah, your thoughts?
Well, I think that age is an important factor both in how old you were when you listened to the song, because I certainly didn't get this song when I was 10. Not really. I mean, I liked it, but only because it was a Monkees song. But I get it now in the same way that everybody else on the panel does, because, you know, we all got to get up and do the 8-to-5 thing. I think the age of
unless
the
you're Dolly
singer,
Parton.
Sorry?
Unless you're Dolly Parton.
Ah, point. Then it's 9-to-5.
Yes.
But the age of the singer, I think, brings different things to the song. Because I will say that in 1967, Davey probably did this song better than Peter would have. But I think Peter would have brought some interesting things to it, just as he did to Shades of Grey. Mm-hmm. I love his part in Shades of Grey. But I actually, if we're talking all the versions of this song, my favorite is how Peter is doing this song now, both live and on the most recent Shoe Suede Blues album, Step by Step, because this song sounds very different coming from a 72-year-old versus a 22-year-old, and it just gives it that extra level of depth and life experience.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Earlier I was talking about Shades of Grey and how I feel it could go toe-to-toe with any Beatles song. I would also say that Randy Scouse Git, our next track, could go toe-to-toe with any Beatles song.
She's a wonderful lady and she's mine, all mine. And there doesn't seem a way that she won't come and lose my mind. It's too easy humming songs to a girl in yellow dress. It's been a long time since the party and the room is in a mess. The four kings of EMI are sitting stately on the floor. There are birds out on the sidewalk and a valet at the door. He reminds me of a penguin with few and plaster hair. There's talcum powder on the letter and the birthday boy is there. Why don't you cut your hair? Why don't you live on...
I feel that this was genius. Just his writing on this is just amazing, and I don't know what got him to this point, but it was one of the best things that he's ever written. Craig Cohen, I'll let you take lead on this one.
Oh, wow. I think this is a great example of what living life can really give you when it comes to writing songs, and why artists early on in their career write some of their better songs, because they're still living life and still experiencing things. And I think that's very much the case with Mickey here. He was in another country and inspired. There's so much in this song that I like. I think the tempo changes are great, and I particularly love the end of the song where you sort of have those dueling vocals that are going on.
Yeah.
So those are, I mean, this is just, it's Mickey's masterpiece, and it's amazing that this is his first solo co-write, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
Or his not co-write, his first solo.
Yeah, completely written by him.
Yeah.
Which is amazing when you think about it, where Mickey was coming from, where he always sort of thought of this gig as, I was hired to act the part of a monkey, and here he is writing this amazing, amazing career-defining song.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Jeff Hewlett?
Oh, man. This is worse than Sunny Girlfriend.
No.
I'm kidding.
I'm kidding. My inner sociopath has shown.
Blasphemer.
No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not going to pass judgment on the song. It's I'm not going to expand much on what Craig Cohen said, but I'm just going to share a little bit of a story of myself when I was a younger person. And I had first heard this song, and I didn't understand it. But I when I was younger, I kind of thought this was one of those songs that were just kind of nonsense lyrics to, to be funny or to be cheeky in a way. And once I got older and I knew more about the Monkees' history and Monkees meet up with the Beatles, and I started to understand what this song really was about. And I my perspective on it changed completely, and I realized that it was actually a brilliant retelling of Nikki's experiences. And some of the slang that's used in the song may have been alien to American audiences, as it was alien to me. Specifically, the "there are birds out on the sidewalk" line. I always thought that meant there were actual birds on the sidewalk. And then I realized, well, birds is a slang term for girls. And I was really like, well, you know, he's hanging out with the Beatles, and of course there's a ton of girls hanging out on the street, right? You know, hoping to catch a glimpse. And, you know, then it started to make sense to me, and I realized the actual genius that was involved in the writing of this track, and I appreciated it a hell of a lot more once I really understood the meaning of everything behind the lyrics.
I agree. Craig Smith?
I agree with everything that's been said so far, except that it is Mickey's masterpiece. I would put one song above this.
Which is?
Shall we put that spoiler out there now? Or
yeah, do
we...
it, man. Do it. Because there's some people that may never hear the other episode and vice versa. So
I think that Shorty Blackwell is his masterpiece.
Wow.
I think that is an incredibly great piece of music.
Going bold.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow. Excellent.
I think it takes incredible turns, and the melodies are way more daring and rewarding, and I just think it's way more sections than this, and it's the kind of song that still holds my interest. Not to say that this doesn't. I think that this is a brilliant song. I've always loved this song. The thing that interests me about this song is I kind of wonder what's... Obviously, it's a Mickey Penn song. I want to know how it sounds when he brings it to the band. I want to know what was there. Obviously, you probably had the lyrics, probably had the melody, but was he strumming it on an acoustic guitar for everyone? Did Peter come up with that piano riff? I'm sure he probably did. So
He probably had that drum riff, that boom.
That he may have had. And I'm not saying this to take away from Mickey at all, but I'm wondering exactly how much of it was Mickey and how much were the other guys and Chip kind of developing it with him. And, I mean, it doesn't matter. It came out incredibly.
And here is a clip of Chip Douglas discussing Randy Scouse's skit and working with Mickey during that time. This originally aired on the Monkees Hour on WBAU-FM.
People just want to do their own thing, and I guess it was the case of the Monkees. You know, they just wanted to do their own thing, and Mike had his approach, which he felt I wasn't into, you know, and Mickey had his approach. Mickey was a little more far out, you know, and he liked kind of the far out approach to things, like that Randy Scouse skit that he wrote. And I remember we argued about that a bit, you know, and I said, geez, you know, it seems so peculiar to me. You know, I was very much commercial-minded, I guess, wanting to get something that would, you know, was more normally acceptable. And after a while, I just kind of, you know, let Mickey do his own thing on Randy Scouse skit, because I thought he was nuts, to tell you the truth on that, with a kettle drum and everything, and it seemed so peculiar to me. But looking back, it was great, you know, and it was a great idea. And it was things like that, I guess, where we'd clash, and one guy would have one idea, and one guy'd have another, that eventually, you know, makes people go their separate ways, you know. That happens a lot in the music business, I guess, you know. Unless you have a wonderful rapport that just works. And in the case of the Monkees, they began to scatter apart as a group. And I would be the guy who was always hanging around at their houses and wishing all these various hangers-on weren't there, you know, so that we could just get the four guys together quietly and privately in a room and collaborate again, you know. And to me, all the various friends that were around him were just beginning to get in the way, and they were beginning to isolate them from one another, you know. And it was sad to me, you know, that they didn't hang out together. They you know, after they worked together for 12 hours a day or whatever it was, they go their separate ways, and they wouldn't want to see each other until they, you know, had to get back together and, you know, work on the set there, you know. So anyway, that was basically the reason, I guess.
Sarah Clark.
This is one of those songs that it makes me want to grab Mickey by the scruff of the neck and go, why didn't you write more stuff? Because he in number, he had relatively few contributions to the catalog, but what he did was stellar. I would just barely slightly give Randy Scouse get the edge over Shorty Blackwell. It's a very close call, and I think people of goodwill can disagree on it. But it's just, you see all of the raw talent that Mickey has, both as a songwriter and as a performer, and it just makes you wonder what if he had channeled his songwriting talents in sort of the same way that Michael Nesmith's channeled his?
During Mickey's time in the UK, he came upon a show that I believe was called Till Death Do Us Part, which was basically the equivalent of what we would know as something like All in the Family. Mm-hmm. May have even been the same writers, maybe. It was linked somehow, but in the episode he was watching, the phrase Randy Scouse Git was uttered, and he immediately took that as the title of the song. It came out here in the States, and when it was pulled for release as a single in the UK, they told him, I don't believe it's this way on the album, I believe it's just a single, the label told him that he had to change the title, which he begrudgingly did to Alternate Title, because Randy Scouse Git is loosely translated in Brits speak as horny Liverpudlian jerk. Or as Mickey says on stage now, horny Liverpudlian putts.
Yes. And of course, there's a lyrical reference to the Four Kings of EMI.
Yes.
Reference, that's right.
To
the and Beatles. Talcum powder.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. On the letter.
Yes, very good, very good. Just an excellent end to an excellent album. Well, we want to thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us. We hope you enjoyed our look at the Monkees Headquarters album. We want to thank you once again. Who knew we'd romp so much during a Sunny Girlfriend, huh, guys?
Yeah.
That should be a standalone episode in itself.
Yeah, well, I think it's great. And it's great to disagree and still be agreeable.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We love you,
so.
Jeff.
And here is a clip of Chip Douglas. This originally aired on the Monkees Hour on WBAU-FM.
Well, what was it like when you first got them into the studio for the Headquarters sessions, because they were as unfamiliar playing as a band together as you were producing?
Well, it was kind of rough at first. Mickey was kind of tense on the drums, and Peter, you know, did all right on the piano and stuff. He was a good, versatile musician. You know, he played guitar and everything, and it was kind of, we didn't know what we were doing and what kind of a sound we wanted and who to get to play what. And at first we had Mike's good friend John London playing some bass with the group, you know. And then for some reason I got in there and started playing bass after a while. I just felt like, in those days, I was so used to being a bass player that I wanted to, you know, play with them. It was the only way I felt I could kind of keep the thing together, was to give them some sort of a solid foundation of sound to, you know, build upon, because Mickey wasn't that steady a drummer, and that was the main thing that was a little bit difficult. Was Mickey's drumming was he was inexperienced at the time. He's become a much better drummer now, you know, and is more relaxed about it. It's second nature to him, but at the time he was just starting into the drums, and that was the roughest part, I think, was finding the steady beat, you know. And it came together after a while, you know. Certain songs were easier than others for some reason, and but the first sessions were rough. We weren't used to each other or anything, and here we were all on our own, you know. And there was a big lawsuit going on with Don Kirshner and all of this stuff, and You know, it was kind of tense at times, you know, it was a wonderful time, you know, and they had a lot of love for that project that they were doing. They wanted to succeed at playing their own instruments, so they were very determined.
Now, the album tracks on Headquarters are some of the Monkees' best songs. Out of great tunes like You Just May Be the One, No Time, and For Pete's Sake, why wasn't a single ever pulled? With the LP at number one, any single would have been a surefire hit.
Yeah, I guess it would have. Lester Sill was kind of in charge of what was going to be released as a single, and I guess he just didn't hear something that he felt would have been a good single at the time. Also, they felt that it would help sell the album, I think, was to not release a single for some reason. It was just sort of, they were so popular with the show that they just kind of didn't need a single right then, I guess. And I wasn't quite sure what the philosophy there was. They would frequently release a single and then they would put it in the following album. And we did that Daydream Believer, and it wasn't even in Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones. It was in the album after that. So they had a kind of a strange philosophy of marketing going at that time, which I didn't quite understand. It's just one of the things they did. I guess they just didn't feel there was something that was quite strong enough to be the single or something like that. It must have been.
And now, from August 27th, 1967, at the Coliseum in Spokane, Washington, off of the Rhino Handmade set, The Monkees, Summer 1967, off of Disc 4.
I'd like to do a song off of our latest album called Headquarters. Oh, you know it. It's called Scroungy Girlfriend. She owned and operates her own sunshine factory. Painting smiles on dolls and then on my knee. Smile, sunny girlfriend and personality.
Mickey has written only one, he says. It's not so, Mickey. You wrote another one. I heard you sing Happy Birthday the other day. He wrote the song, and it's so far out that not even Mickey knows what it means.
And I don't care.
He barely knows how to spell it.
Been a long time since the party, and the room is in a mess.
a most unusual concert. We have you to thank for that.
Great setup, guys. Great setup.
Everything is absolutely running according to clockwork.
My drums are disintegrating.
That is if you have a $3 clock.
You can find these at Amazon.com in the MP3 section. Do a search for Summer 1967, the complete U.S. recordings, The Monkees. And now here's the ever wonderful Ghosty Timmers, returning to our show in a way that only he can, with what we're going to call an alternate take on Monkees history. Take it away, Ghosty.
On today's episode of the Zilch Podcast, we'll examine the question, how would history have changed if the Monkees had never recorded the Headquarters album? To answer this question, we have to go back to late 1966, when a young Michael Nesmith, aggravated by the group's lack of creative control, approached Bob Rafelson and Bert Schneider to ask if the band could oversee the creation of their next album. The two hip producers denied Nesmith his request, urging the singer-songwriter to not, and I quote, rock the boat. Nesmith responded by putting his two fists through Rafelson and Schneider's office wall, exclaiming, that could have been your face. And that could have been your face too. In January of 1967, the album More of the Monkees was released. Music supervisor Don Kirshner followed that up with Even More of the Monkees in May of that year, and finally, Furthermore of the Monkees in November, despite its title being grammatically incorrect. But by that time, it hardly mattered. Mike Nesmith had bought out his contract and quit the group. With the TV show still in production, the producers replaced Nesmith with the young actor Ted McGinley. McGinley, who was only 9 years old at the time, could neither sing or perform music, but, being a tiny tot, he was unquestionably even cuter than Davy Jones. Ratings for the Monkees skyrocketed, and eventually the show was retooled to feature Ted McGinley almost exclusively. Peter Tork, Mickey Dolenz, and Davy Jones found themselves unemployed as Rafelson and Schneider put all of their production clout into a feature-length film starring McGinley. It was simply called Ted. A runaway family-friendly blockbuster, Raybert spent the next decade churning out beloved children's classics before retiring after failing to turn the four-legged star of the 1980s TV series Here's Boomer into a recording act. As for the other former Monkees, Davy Jones starred in a popular 1970s revival of the TV series Mr. Ed before becoming a color commentator for the Kentucky Derby. Peter Tork opened a small boutique on the Sunset Strip called Waterbeds and Brown Rice, which eventually became a nationwide chain store called Waterbeds, Bath, and Beyond. Mickey Dolenz would audition for the role of the Fonz on TV's Happy Days, but would instead be offered the role of Potsy, which he took, and was eventually reunited with actor Ted McGinley. While Michael Nesmith, the impetus for the Monkees' changing musical fortunes in the 1960s, retired from music completely and opened up a small typewriter repair shop. As for the music critics, who gleefully attacked the Monkees in early 1967 for their prefabricated music, without the Monkees to kick around anymore, they had no choice but to turn on each other. The feeble potshots each rock critic took at each other grew tiresome for readers, and by 1970, rock critics went the way of the dinosaur. So you see, some good would have come out of all of this had the Monkees not recorded Headquarters. But we're glad they did.
That's really groovy. There's just, there's something missing. I think. She's not like it was. You should have heard some of the things after today's show. Unbelievable.
You know what I'd like to do now?
What?
Put the other harmony part to those empty bridges on Mike's songs.
Okay.
Could we do that?
It's hard to imagine Monkees' history without Headquarters. It's a landmark album for all of us fans. I think it's 50% of what makes the whole Monkees story so exciting. Let me ask you listeners, if Headquarters would never have happened, how do you think it would have changed how we thought about the Monkees? What would have happened with the Monkees' history? How would have things been different? Let us know your thoughts, and if you'd like to record an MP3 under 2 minutes long and send it to us via our email address, zilchmonkees@gmail.com. That email address again is zilchmonkees@gmail.com.
And that's our show. Zilch is an online nonprofit Monkees audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the Monkees or any of their members past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burr. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.